Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Do you know a student getting ready to go to college? Or are you looking at going back to school yourself? The Woodward Hines Education Foundation and the Get to College program help more Mississippians get to and through college to get certificates and degrees that lead to meaningful employment. They offer free college planning advice, including hands-on FAFSA completion assistance through in-person or virtual appointments. Visit gettocollege.org to learn more.
Good morning. It's 8:30 on Tuesday, May 7th. I'm Desiree Frazier. This is Mississippi Edition on MPB Think Radio. On today's show, a recently passed bill could prevent trans people from using public bathrooms and certain spaces in public schools, universities, and prisons. Then we continue our conversation with the state health officer about important medical issues facing Mississippi. Plus, it's Hurricane Preparedness Week. What you need to know if evacuations are ordered. This is Mississippi Edition on MPB Think Radio. State lawmakers recently sent a bill to the governor's desk which could prevent trans people from using public bathrooms and other certain public spaces. The SAFER Act would allow private citizens to directly file lawsuits against someone they feel violates the law. The bill was passed less than a month after President Biden made changes to the federal Title IX law, which strengthened anti-discrimination laws to protect trans Americans in public settings. Our Will Stribling speaks with McKenna Rainey Gray, attorney with the ACLU of Mississippi, about the SAFER Act.
I think that the difference between the Title IX regulation and Mississippi's SAFER Act just really clearly shows the differences in priorities between the different administrations. So Title IX is clarifying a rule that has already been interpreted in lots of places, that Title IX prohibition against sex discrimination in educational settings includes students' gender identity and sexual orientation. So it takes the definition of sex, they just clarify what that includes. And that is strengthening protections for LGBTQ students in schools, whereas Mississippi thought it was really important to pass a discriminatory ban that's going to make it so that queer and trans students, trans and gender nonconforming students, are going to have other things on their mind instead of education.
Lynn Fitch and other AGs have already sued over these new Title IX rules. Do you expect the implementation of these new Title IX rules to be held up by this lawsuit from states?
The argument from Mississippi Attorney General and other states' attorneys general are saying that the final rule, the final version of the Title IX rule regulation that has been promulgated, violates the Administrative Procedures Act because it is relying on an interpretation that conflicts with the text of the statute. I think it's going to me, it's seems likely that it's going to be, the rule is going to be held up because the definition of, like, multiple courts have already found that discrimination on the basis of sex, like, by definition necessarily has to include discrimination on the basis of sexual orientation and gender identity. That's not a new concept. That's not a new legal argument. And I think that legal theory challenging the Title IX regulation is just an attempt to delay enforcement to the extent that they can. But I do think that it's likely that that rule is going to be held up.
How do you think this legislation compares to the anti-trans legislation proposed and passed in other states this year? I know there have been a lot of efforts on that front. And it was also interesting to me that we returned to the bathroom issue. And, you know, when I think about that, that was like the big debate in 2017, right?
So your first question was about kind of where we stand compared to other states. I will say Florida passed a similar law, but their violation did not occur at the threshold of the restroom. Their violation occurs when somebody has asked you to leave and you refuse to. So the Mississippi version of a similar bill is much much broader and potentially way easier for somebody to transgress unknowingly. If you don't know that that's a rule, then if a teenage girl runs into the bathroom crying and her dad needs to go get her, he is not allowed to walk into a restroom to get his teenage daughter in a high school, in a university, in an administrative building. There's just all sorts of scenarios where we don't need such potentially high civil liability for walking into a space, particularly when we already have rules and regulations and laws and criminal things that people are worried about. If you harass somebody, it doesn't matter where you are. If it's criminal conduct, it's criminal conduct. If you are threatening somebody or you are assaulting somebody, that conduct is already criminalized and prohibited. That's not something that we necessarily need this legislation to impact, even though that is something that was discussed at length on the floor. The framing of this bill is that it is going to protect women, and that's not at all what is going to be happening with this bill. It is just creating civil liability for any person who goes into the opposite sex restroom, regardless of their motivations.
And so going back to the Title IX rules, transgender students facing unequal treatment in instances like them being denied access to public restrooms and changing rooms could trigger an investigation by the Education Department's Office for Civil Rights. What does an investigation of that nature look like, and does it have any teeth? Like, is it something that could actually have an impact here?
Yeah, if a student or their parent files an Office for Civil Rights complaint with the Department of Education, that's going to trigger an investigation by the federal government into whether or not this is discriminatory and whether or not this is something that merits further investigation. If they find that some of the Department of Education rules, in this case it would probably be based on Title IX, have been violated, then the school is liable for, like, it's possible that they can lose federal funding if they don't reach an agreement with the federal government for a remediation plan to ensure that they're not going to continue to have this kind of behavior or outcomes in the future. So I would say that an Office for Civil Rights complaint definitely has a lot at stake for a school if they're found to have violated the rules.
And going back to the civil liabilities element of this.
So I think the private enforcement is a really intentionally vague scheme that they've put together. It says that a person may assert a violation of this act. A violation, presumably, as they said on the floor, is if somebody has gone into the, quote, wrong bathroom, so that would be going into the restroom that is different from their sex assigned at birth, then presumably they've committed a violation. Similarly, for going into a person's dorm room, you're not allowed to go into an opposite sex dorm room under the terms of this law. And changing room is the same analysis. It says that you can assert a violation. It doesn't actually say who you can sue. So on the floor, Joey Hood said, I would sue the person who walked into the bathroom. They didn't put that in the law, though. So it could be the dean of students at a university that is facing a lawsuit. It could be the RA. It could be a parent of somebody who's gone into the bathroom. It's not clear through the text of the law how this kind of lawsuit would even go forward. And I think that that's for the legislature to put forward a new cause of action with so little guardrails on who it is intended to protect, who is it intended to be brought against, and what even an act is, like what even the violation is.
McKenna Renee, or rather Rainey Gray, is the LGBTQ Justice Project staff attorney with the ACLU of Mississippi. Coming up, we continue our conversation with the state health officer about important medical issues facing Mississippi. And this is Mississippi Edition on MPB Think Radio.
I'm guessing that MPB Think Radio is the number one preset on your radio and you listen all the time. But if you need some unplugged listening suggestions, try a binge of one of our podcasts. Our weekend shows, This American Life and Radio Lab, are great to have downloaded for when you're traveling or at the beach. Don't forget about our local shows, Now You're Talking and Creature Comforts are terrific experiences anytime. MPB Podcasts, for your listening pleasure, anywhere.
From children's education to gripping drama, documentaries to comedy, MPB Television brings the world to Mississippi. With local stories, cooking, health, and music, MPB Television takes Mississippi to the world.
This is Mississippi Edition on MPB Think Radio. I'm Desiree Frazier. Mississippi has one of the lowest dollar-to-resident ratios for public health spending in the nation. For instance, neighboring states like Alabama and Louisiana spend roughly $40 per person on public health. In Mississippi, it's closer to 18. Dr. Dan Edney is the state health officer. In part two of our conversation, he tells our Michael McEwen, chronic underfunding of public health in Mississippi is a monumental hurdle.
Been practicing medicine for 33 years, and this is the most challenging thing that I've had to do because I'm looking at field services that oversees the county health departments as a patient in need of treatment. And right now she's pretty sick, but she's not as sick as she was a year ago. And these are things, you know, Dr. Currier had to respond to the crisis of a 40% budget cut. I'd like anybody to sustain that, you know, for your income to be slashed 40%. And then Dr. Dobbs recognized the need and began the right treatments, but then the pandemic hit, and then it kept hitting every time that we tried to work on it. You know, it just kept hitting. And then when I became state health officer, and it was just very obvious that we were in trouble and that we had to make some serious changes of reform. And a lot of that had to happen. It's when you look at a state system of health care provision, a lot of times it's spending the money you have instead of determining, you know, what budget do you need, and we're having to really re-educate our whole system to understand what true overhead is and what it should be and what it has to be and how do you really utilize healthcare workforce. Knowing you can't compete with the, you cannot compete with the private sector, how do you manage in the world that we're in so that we have a healthy workforce? And we're having to rebuild our workforce from the pandemic right now. And the key part that I'm really pushing is you increase revenue. And we've not done a good job with that. And our revenue generation through our clinical operations has steadily been increasing the last 2 years, and it has continued to increase. And that's where changing our whole model is important. So, you know, if someone does have Medicaid, that we're billing Medicaid properly. We are billing certain insurance companies that never would pay us before, and they're beginning to pay us. That's more revenue that goes back into the county health departments.
You yourself, you're from the Delta.
Yes.
There was an interesting effort this session to create the Delta Health Authority.
Yes.
What are your thoughts on that?
It's not just the Delta, it's all of western Mississippi, including Warren County, my home county. Yeah. Because the number one determining factor of your health outcomes is your zip code. And it didn't matter what your insurance is. If you live in certain zip codes, you're going to have difficulty accessing health care. Areas like Issaquena County, you got to drive a long way. Mm-hmm. You start having chest pain in Myersville, you're a long way from a cath lab.
Yep.
So that's part of rural health challenges. When you're looking at the Delta that across the board has 15% worse outcomes than the rest of the state, and the rest of the state's not good, you know, they need more medicine. And Southwest Mississippi is right behind them. I mean, right behind them. And when you look west of I-55, those outcomes, they just fall off the cliff. What we have to do in population health is to look at the populations that are very different. So you can't use the same medicine, the same dose, in the same way for two very different regions. You diagnose the problem. A lot of those are social determinants of health, like transportation. Certainly poverty drives everything, but you know, living with no surrounding health care, living in a food desert, you know, all the things that SDOHs impact. And then making the diagnosis, determining the right medicine, and then determining the right dosage of medicine, and then how you administer it. That's how we handle healthcare in the rest of the world. It makes sense to me in public health. And so it should make sense to most reasonable people that when a population is sicker than the rest of the regions and with different challenges and lower resources, West and East may need the same medicine, but I'm going to tell you, West Mississippi needs a higher dose of medicine. Mm-hmm. And then you have to administer them differently. So when you're looking at impacted minority communities, you don't treat the Vietnamese population on the Gulf Coast the same way you do the Hispanic population in Scott County. You have to look at each population differently. That's what we do. We look at Delta outcomes versus non-Delta outcomes. And the Delta has gotten so low with healthcare investment levels. And so I'm a strong advocate for regional health authorities as a potential strong solution for areas like the Delta and Southwest Mississippi. But these are voluntary authorities. These are not mandated things, and they're not government-run things. They're government-authorized. But I can tell you, I don't see any way the Delta gets another NICU again without a health authority.
State Health Officer Dr. Dan Edney. Coming up, it's Hurricane Preparedness Week. What you need to know if evacuation orders are issued. This is Mississippi Edition on MPB Think Radio.
What's your favorite type of music? The old standards? Country? A specific type of jazz? Maybe you love classical. In addition to Think and Radio Reading Service, we broadcast MPB Music Radio. Listen live to essential and emerging artists from your HD radio, our app, or from mpbonline.org. MPB Think Radio. Whatever your taste, news, music, storytelling, or how-to shows. Whatever your city, Natchez, Jackson, Tupelo, Cleveland. However you want. Radio, smart speaker, smartphone app. MPB Think Radio.
This is Mississippi Edition on MPB Think Radio. I'm Desiree Frazier. It's Hurricane Preparedness Week in Mississippi. Experts are sharing important details about how to get ready for any potential storms. When a local emergency manager issues an evacuation order, it's important to have everything you may need ready to go. Anna Ergot is a spokesperson with the Mississippi Department of Transportation. She tells our Kobe Vance, knowing your evacuation route and having easy access to road trip supplies can make a huge difference when traveling.
Some of the things that MDOT wants people to be aware of during this time is to go ahead and assess your situation and also be prepared to go ahead and figure out what the best way for you to evacuate is should you need to evacuate. One of the things that we encourage people to do this week and throughout hurricane season is to visit our website at gomdot.com/hurricanes to download the hurricane evacuation guide. And that is a really important resource that features not only a hurricane evacuation map where you can find more than 20 different hurricane evacuation routes. You can also get some tips on evacuating there. They also have some contraflow information and also some important contacts just in case you need them when you are on the road.
So one of the common things that you hear about in times of hurricanes is those evacuation routes that you mentioned. And with more than 20 routes, what are some ways that folks can try to figure out what's the best for them?
Sure. So one of the things that we usually advise for people is that we know that Highway 49 can become very congested during a hurricane evacuation event. So we really encourage people to take alternate routes that maybe don't involve Highway 49. And you can really just look on the map and see, you know, where you are and where you're planning to go and use the map to figure out what the best way to get to your destination may be. And, you know, again, taking into account those alternate routes that may not be quite as congested as some of the more highly utilized routes, such as 49 and, of course, I-10. We know that has a lot of traffic on it. Just generally speaking. So you'll want to go ahead and map out those routes. And, of course, another important consideration as you prepare for hurricane season is to figure out where you're going to go. And a lot of times people will stay with friends and family up north, or they'll have a favorite hotel where they like to stay. So if you can go ahead and maybe make those calls to friends or family now to make sure that they can accommodate you should you need to go visit them for a few days, go ahead and do that. And also, you know, if you have a favorite hotel where you like to stay in, say, Hattiesburg or Jackson or Meridian, Brookhaven, what have you, go ahead and figure out, you know, what exact hotel you like. And as soon as you make the decision to evacuate, go ahead and book that hotel so that you can make sure that you're in the place where you might be most comfortable.
What are some things that y'all suggest people have on the ready in case they need to get in their car and go?
Sure. One of the things that is, of course, really important to have, you know, in addition to, you know, some of the clothes and things like that that you would pack, of course, is to have some water on hand. You may be stuck in traffic for a while, and we want to make sure that people are hydrated, of course. And another thing is that if you plan to stay behind, it's very important to have water on hand, not just for drinking, but also for cooking and hygiene, and also some water for your pets. A few other things that you'll want to be sure to bring in case of an evacuation is, of course, any medications that you might need, prescription, non-prescription drugs, maybe some vitamins, some hygiene items, of course. And another important consideration, what you'll do with your pets. Also, be sure to pack any important documents with you as well as any photos.
Some people will choose to stay at their homes for a while during a storm, and they might need to get out on the roads. Other people might be staying until last minute and have to travel during the first parts of the storm. And then you have other people who, even they might live upland, deeper into the state, but they still have some damage in their area. So for those people, what is y'all's advice for people who have to get out and there might be debris on the road or there might be some other dangerous conditions?
We really encourage people not to get out on the roads during a hurricane, of course, and in the aftermath of a hurricane. We know that we have debris that is often in the roadways immediately following a storm. Many people don't realize this, but MDOT crews are actually first responders, and the crews will come out as soon as it is safe to do so following a hurricane and will work to clear the roads of debris and get the roads passable again so that emergency vehicles can get through. And that's really our first priority after a storm, is to make sure that emergency vehicles can get through. And another one of the reasons that we really, really strongly suggest that people do not travel just following a storm, because, of course, we are going to be out, we're going to be removing that debris, and we want to make sure that emergency vehicles can get to people who are experiencing an emergency.
Anna Ergot is a spokesperson with the Mississippi Department of Transportation. Thank you so much for your time today.
Sure, thank you.
This has been Mississippi Edition on MPB Think Radio.